Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Inside College Soccer. It's been a little while. We took off a few weeks, in fact, about a month. Well, we had some internet issues coming from where I record from. But we've got that all sorted out now. And I'm excited about having this next guest on. Joe Flanagan and I have known each other going back to late 90s, I guess. Early 2000s, I coached at Cal State East Bay on the women's side, and Joe was at Cal State Dominguez Hills and was coaching the men and the women at Cal State Dominguez Hills. And Joe, I always hated coming and playing you, man. Hated playing at your field, hated playing at that stadium. And it wasn't just the location, Joe, is that we knew that we were going all the way down there and probably going to get our asses kicked. You had a really good run with your men's and women's programs there for a few years. And I don't want to steal all your thunder. I'll let you talk about it a little bit. But welcome to the Inside College Soccer, Joe.
Well, thanks for having me. Yes, we had some good times back then. I think that, I had the men's program from 1994 till 2017, and then the women's program concurrently 2002 through 2013, I believe. And so that decade, or, you know, that between 2000 and 2013, like, both teams were very competitive, and, you know, we won two national titles during that time with my men's team. The girls team lost in the national finals in 2009. And, you know, we had a nice little run there. It was a good decade, a little more than a decade, but it was a fun time, and a lot of things came together at the right time there. So I look back with that in fond memories. I mean, my kids were all young during that time, coming to games. It was just a soccer life, and they remember those Friday night games and hanging out with the team and having team dinners and all that stuff. And so it's something they cherish as well.
Right on. And that was all with local kids, right? You weren't bringing in internationals like we see today, right?
You know, it's funny, like, no, I wasn't. And I didn't know anything, you know, on the West Coast, we didn't really know much different, I don't think. I mean, it was so hard in the late 90s, early 2000s to get in the playoffs. It was like two teams from the region usually got in. And on the men's side, it was always Seattle Pacific was always the top team that you had to kind of go. So they were always getting one of the spots, and the rest of us in the West region were battling for the other spot. I mean, it was crazy. So finally in 2000, we became the number one team in the country going into the playoffs. We hadn't been in the playoffs before. Now it's just like, I just want to get a taste of the NCAA. That's all I wanted. I didn't care about winning a national title. I was like, we got to get to the playoffs. That's all I wanted to do. And of course, we were 19-1-1 at the end of the season. And I was like, man, now everybody's going to expect us to get to the Final Four. We're number one in the country, you know? But we didn't know what to expect. We'd never been there before. And first round, we played Seattle Pacific. We beat them. And then we played West Texas A&M. And they had a couple international guys, nothing big, though. We got to the Final Four, and it was all international guys. And I was like, whoa, what have we got ourselves into here? Like, I was dealing with guys from Redondo Beach, Cerritos, La Habra, you know. I think we had one guy from Northern Cal, and the rest of the guys from Long Beach, you know, just probably within an hour of our campus. And I was like, man, this is going to be interesting, you know. And, you know, there wasn't much video available back then like that. Right. So you had no idea what you're walking into. And so here we were, a bunch of local kids, and playing against these guys from all over the world. And we went there and won a national title in 2000. And that was, The game went into four overtimes, and we won it 2-1 against Barry University, but that was our real first taste. And it's great to win a national title, but I always say too, it was great that we never hit a barrier. Like, we got in the playoffs and won a national title in our first time. So it wasn't like we got to the first round and then we had to get back to the next year and say, okay, we got to get by the first round. It's like we got into the playoffs and won the national title. And it was like, oh, okay. It was a great, there was no, after that, there was no like, we hit a wall. We never hit a wall. We
This wasn't
had
that
the,
hard. We should have just done this every year.
yeah. So, and we did feel though the CCA was a very competitive conference, and we felt like it. Every CCA team will tell you this. I think that the CCA will prepare you, especially during that time. I know things have changed a little bit, but during that time, the CCA did prepare you for a very competitive. If you got out of the CCA and got out of the West region, you were kind of battle tested.
I've always said top to bottom, the CCAA is the best, deepest conference, Division II conference in the country on the men's side for sure, but we're probably on the women's side too.
Yeah, I think there was a time there the women's side wasn't, and then it got almost better than the men. Like, it was just deep. And I think I always said, like, in theory, you have to play well to win in the CCA. You can't go and play at 60%, 70% and win, because that last place team will beat you.
They
So you
will
got,
be, right? Yeah.
so they'll it, that's what you got to be ready on a day-to-day basis. There's no easy ones. You can't phone it in,
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So you were Dominguez Hills for how long, Joe?
I was actually there for 32 years, four years as a player, 4 years as an assistant coach, and then 24 years as a head coach.
Crazy. So at some point, as happens to all of us, some athletic director or somebody in administration decides they can do better, right? That we're not
Correct.
the right person for the program anymore. So you took off from there and you went to where?
Went to Marymount, California, a small NAIA school located in Palos Verdes. Pretty close to where I live, and they had a pretty good soccer history too. They had a good little program going, but NAI, this was 2018 or 2019, I think, when I got the job, and so obviously things have changed, and NAI was always been a little more international. So when I got there was a lot of international guys there. The previous coach was an English coach who definitely recruited more on the international side. Which, again, I'm not anti that, but I was born and raised in Southern California, so that's my strength, is knowing the local communities and programs of where to recruit, and also during that time, my older son Cade was he graduated from high school in 2018, so I his last year of playing club, I coached his team, so I knew a bunch of those high school age kids too. So it always kept me somewhat involved. And so when I got the job at Marymount, we had some international guys, and my assistant coach was a Brazilian guy, great guy, I got him Ronaldo, and he knew some international stuff, and I did some local stuff, and we had a good combination of both going into year two. Year two actually was our COVID year, so we didn't have a season. And then year three, we actually made it to the quarterfinals of the NAIAs with more domestic kids than, the story was we were like one of the top scoring teams in the country, and we were dealing with a lot of domestic kids, and like people were calling me like, how are you doing this with all these domestic kids? Because every other team was international.
Right.
And I was like, hey, look, this is who I am. I recruit locally. I know some good players locally that are just looking for an opportunity. And I'm always a big believer in that. There's so many kids in California, just because I know that. I'm not saying that other states aren't like that, but just I know Southern California, there's so many nooks and crannies of good players that get lost, and just looking for an opportunity. And I try to find those kids, and I was lucky enough to do that at Dominguez as well as Marymount.
Yeah, and look, I think Joe, I think you hit on something because I really do believe, and having traveled coast to coast in this country myself at events that there are kids in every pocket of this country, but especially major metropolitan areas. So if you take, Southern California, Northern California, the greater Dallas, Texas, Fort Worth area, or DC metro area, anyhow, major metropolitan areas, that there are a lot of domestic-based players that are extremely talented who can help teams even at that level, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's where the depth of talent when it comes to recruiting, I think that's why, on the men's side, there's takes a little longer because there's just a more depth of talent top to, in terms of numbers, on the men's side. I think the girls' side is getting deeper. That talent pool is getting deeper, but that's why in the beginning when recruiting started, you looked at the girls and they were committing it in ninth grade, eighth grade at times, like the top girls were getting, and you're like, whoa, how's this even happening? Where the bench side was always your recruiting your end of your junior year if you're a good player, so yeah, these major cities, especially some we always talk about as a soccer purist. The love of the game, these inner city kids that go to the local park and play there with their uncles and play on Sunday leagues with their dads. And, these are the kids that have these instincts sometimes that, you bring them into a good environment and all of a sudden those instincts around good players, like just they just go up three or four notches, so, having that ability to find those players and again, those players sometimes are can be very hungry too, and they want to prove and show, and this is what they really want to, they want this opportunity. So there's a hunger and desire there that's great to have as a coach.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's so true, huh? So you're at Marymount, and then I just remember reading that Marymount was closing down, that they were going to change school, and I don't know. I probably let it sit 3 weeks, but immediately I thought, Joe, come work with us, man. You'd be fantastic.
Yeah,
You
I
have
remember
so
you
much
and
experience.
I remember when I was at Marymount, you had sent me a couple players to look at, and I think I said to you, like, hey, maybe when I'm done coaching, I wouldn't mind doing something like this. And you're like, oh yeah, let me know. And then I think within a couple months the school closed down and then you called me up or something. So yeah, the timing was good. And I mean it was a crazy time. I mean, obviously we've seen other division small schools kind of close down, and I think our school was wavering on some things, and then COVID hit, and that didn't help. And it's funny because we had just got to the quarterfinals of the NEI national tournament that fall, and then that following April, I think is when they closed down. And so, the on a personal note, it was tough because my son Cade was playing for me, and he was doing really well, and he was going into his senior year. So it would have been his final year playing, and you had graduated there too, but I was 10 wins away, or I still am 10 wins away as a coach from 500 wins total. So that fall, I think I would have got those 10 wins, and my son would have played, and we were gonna have a good team. And I was thinking about it, my son Jack, my younger son Jack had committed to Notre Dame at that point, and I was saying to myself, man, if I continue coaching in college, I'm never going to be able to see my kids play in college, because
True.
my daughter was playing at Western Michigan at the time. She's a couple years younger than my son Kate, and then Jack had just committed to Notre Dame, and then I have a younger daughter Lane, who's now going into her junior year in high school. So I was like, and I never realized that. I was so focused on my college stuff and getting my kids to college that I wasn't ever thinking about, wow, I'm never going to see my kids play in college. So when going into that final season, could have been the final season at Marymount, I was thinking, okay, maybe this is it. Maybe I get through this last year with my son. He'll be a senior, and maybe I start looking at other things. But then the school closed down, and here we are, and we're with SRUSA.
Right. So what have you What have you observed change over the last post-COVID years, the last 3 or 4 post-COVID years? Anything stand out to you that you've said, wow, that's way different than it was, I don't know, 10 years ago?
I think the craziest part of it is how quick things are changing. I mean, you and I both know, being with the NCAA for a long time, that to get something changed took 2, 3, 4 years
Right.
to get a rule change. You know, whether it was a red shirt thing, you know, visits, I mean, you know, limitations on how many times you can watch a player, whatever. It's certain things that the NCAA had. And now, you know, the rule that just came out this past April or May about the free transfers, you can transfer as many times as you want. Well, underneath that too, there's other rules were a part of that too, but it was changed on the, it was basically certified that day. It was ready to go that day. It's like it'll be effective immediately. Usually when a rule happens like that, it'll say effective August of 2025.
Right.
You know, it's like, so now the NCAA is changing dramatically. Every 6 months, it seems like there's something new going on, whether it's a conference realignment, rule changes, obviously NIL stuff. I mean, it's just like and I don't, you know, before it took too long, and now I feel like it's going so quick, it's hard to keep up. It's a you know, doing what we do is trying to help out with players. It's, you know, it is a full-time job to keep up with the changes and keep up with, you know, what's going on with different teams and coaches leaving and
Right.
stuff like that. So I think it's just the quickness of everything is to me the biggest change.
So if you go into your closet there and you bring out your crystal ball and you were gonna make a prediction of where college soccer is going, but let's address the men and then let's address the women, like the changes that are going to happen over the next couple of years, because part of our job, Joe, is trying to make those predictions because we've got maybe sophomore clients that we're going to have to help advise them for what's going to happen in 2 years. And we don't know for a fact, but I do think that you have an educated guess on where this is going. Let's start with the men's game first. What changes do you see happening? How do you see it affecting the average American recruit? And where do you see this going in the next few years?
You know, honestly, I could see it going a couple of different ways, but on the men's side, obviously there was a push a while ago about trying to make it almost like a year-round sport, right? Having it fall and spring and have a spring championship season where you have the playoffs at the end of the spring, right? And for the soccer people out there, that made sense because you weren't cramming a full schedule in 2, 3 months. But as that started to get going, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the MLS clubs were starting academies and they were bringing those kids that were going straight to the pros. They were bypassing college, right? They were going to the pros. So I felt like when that rule of that or that idea started getting forward, I almost felt it was too late, because those professional kids were already jumping to pros. They weren't going to college.
Right.
And so I think that's, I don't even, I haven't even heard of that even being talked about lately. And it was a talk probably, what, before COVID, maybe a lot, maybe after COVID a little bit, but I know before COVID it was a big talk about doing year-round things. But now what I see with the way the NCAA has allowed kind of these conference realignments, and you know, the Pac-12 is no longer, and you have UCLA and USC going, you know, to the ACC and Big Ten and stuff, and it scares me a little bit for the average, the regular soccer player that wants to go to college and play a sport, play soccer. It scares me in terms of when it's just generated, when all these things are generated by money, and we know soccer is not a money sport. So
Right.
where does that leave soccer in the long run? Does it become a USL 2 type situation where you're playing in that type of thing and not playing the NCAA, but you're playing for Notre Dame USL 2, or you're playing for, you know, the Cal State Fullerton USL 2? You know, it could go into a, You're just playing, you're going to that school and playing for a semi-pro team or something. I don't know. I think it's going to be a, we'll see with this conference with Nama stuff how it really plays out, because I'm scared of when it's really all these ideas are generated by money. When they start looking at the amount of money that's being spent on travel and stuff like that, to go back east and go Midwest for regular conference games for multiple sports, not just soccer, that
Right.
scares me a little bit. And you know, the other thing that they don't talk about too much, and it's probably, I don't know how big of a deal is, but like most assistant coaches at soccer are coaching club or coaching something else.
Oh, yeah, good
And
point.
now that they're traveling, doing different things, it probably takes them, takes that away a little bit. It might take money out of their pocket a little bit as well. So there's a lot of layers here that I think could affect these kind of non-revenue sports. And that's what that's kind of scary to me.
Yeah, and that's on, so that's on the men's side. Now I don't know. So, I think you and I right now we're talking about Division One. Do you see it affecting Division Two or Division Three or NAIA or junior college in the same way that it's affecting Division One?
I don't th yeah, I would think Division One is probably the bigger one. Division Two, I think it could affect because of Division Two does rely on NCAA money, right? That money's got to trickle down to Division Two sports. And Division Three, I don't know. Division Three is a different animal to me. It's like you have a kid, a player there that is very good academically usually, and can be a very good player, and those, but it's a that's an academic driven institution usually. So their priorities are a little bit different. It's not just about the sport, right? It's like academics are pretty much first at the Division III school, and the athletics is second. So I think it probably affects Division III probably the least, because they already have their model kind of in place, whereas the Division I, it seems to be, is the one that's constantly changing and trying to make things up as they go. So to me, it probably affects Division I definitely the most, and then Division II probably doesn't affect JC or Division III as much, I don't think.
Yeah, and NAIA, a lot of schools are, 60, 70% of the student population is athletes. So I don't think they can afford to mess with athletics. They're
Well,
smaller
yeah,
schools with smaller enrollments.
that's one of the things when Marymount, California was starting to struggle a little bit. They talked about canceling athletics, and our athletic director was like, "Well, you're going to lose, 500 kids." And they're like, "Oh, you don't think they'll stay?" And she's like, "No, they're going to go somewhere else, and they're going to go play." So yeah, I mean, there is a
Administrators.
lot of NAIA schools that are, based around athletics, and so yeah, it probably, we'll see how it could. Maybe it could help NAIA, with there could be more opportunity there. We'll see.
Well, I know this messiness is helping junior colleges. I know that the quality and caliber of player, even domestic players that are going to junior colleges now that 12 years ago might have made a lower level Division I roster are going that junior college route because of the international player influx, I think has affected what that American player has to do in order to end up at that Division I school that they want to be at. They've got to prove themselves first. No longer is an 18-year-old, be able to prove themselves in the same way, and unless they're a standout, like your son is at Notre Dame. I mean, he's a standout. He's just an unusual player that you don't see a lot of Americans of his quality, but just the average American kid. I think it's helped junior colleges.
Well, yeah, and I think on another note too, you might know this, Don, better than I, but like the number of players that are playing now in 2024 compared to 2000, compared to 2000 or 2005, in the last 20 years, has it increased? Has the numbers increased? And to me, as a coach, I think there's more depth of better players now
Good
than
point.
before. So now, but there's no men's soccer programs opening up, right? There's no new Division I programs opening up for these acts for this bigger population, right? Division One men's soccer has stayed at the same number probably for how long? It probably hasn't changed. You never hear about a school opening up a Division One men's soccer team. You know, what is there, 100 more women's Division One teams than men?
Yeah, roughly. Yeah.
Right around there. So
Yeah.
now with the better, more players playing than ever before, more internationals coming in. So there's just a, it's just a, there's like a jam, traffic jam of players, right? It's like a bottleneck. And I do think the JCs can reap some benefits of that because there are some good players out there that can't get to a Division One or Division Two or maybe even Division Three school. So there's, it's just now, exposing those players to those opportunities.
What do you think's going to happen then, like to the, I'll just pull one that you and I both know, like a Cal State Northridge. So your average state school that is probably is never going to compete for a national championship. They're not going to beat Stanford or Notre Dame, but they're just an average state school playing in an average state league. Do you see this affecting those types of Division One schools?
I mean, yeah, I do. But again, I'm kind of an old school guy. I really feel like having players, giving them the opportunity to play the sport they love and to represent their school is good for the school. And it's good for the players too. But it's good for the school. I would say I played at Cal State Dominguez Hills. We didn't have a football team or, big stuff. I was like, but I obviously hung out with guys and played with guys that went to UCLA and stuff. And so having that type of school pride and cheering on your football team or cheering on your basketball team, cheering on your soccer team,
Right,
it brings some
right.
flavor to your college experience. And I hope that that stays important to these universities where it's not just about the bottom line and the dollar, because I
Right.
think it is important that there's athletic teams on campus that kids that even that are not athletes that go out and watch them play and
Right.
enjoy that experience. So there's a lot of positives to this, and I hope they that but they're intangibles, right? That you have to appreciate that and respect that as an administrator. And sometimes what you hear now is that these athletic directors are all business, and it's about the bottom dollar and the spreadsheets. And if it doesn't match up, then they're going to start cutting sports, and that's a concern of mine, and I'm hoping that there's still some people out there that believe in the power of athletics.
Yeah, and I don't think it's any different than the way that we talk about art or history in, or music in schools. Sorry, art or music in schools. I think that these are important pieces of well-rounded experiences
Absolutely. I mean,
that our
everything,
students
like
should have.
a soccer player taking art, or so, athletes having to take different classes. That's part of the university experience,
Right.
and this is what the school offers. And so, hopefully, we still remain important in the whole process, because I do feel like I'm a big believer in college. It's had its rough moments here over the last probably 3 months with these graduation stuff going on, the protests, stuff like that. But I believe in the college experience, the 18-year-old kid that's going, and maybe that college kid is driven to wants to be a pro in soccer or football, or he wants to be a pro, he wants to be an accountant,
Right.
or he doesn't know what he's doing yet, but he's going somewhere to find out what he wants to do. And then at 22 years old, he's ready to go. I think there's a lot of positives to that. And so hopefully we can continue this journey that allows these student athletes to get to the right place.
So I think the summary is on the men's side, we don't know. We have ideas, but we don't
A lot of
know. But there
variables,
are
a lot of
changes
variables.
coming. There are
Yeah.
changes coming.
Yes.
On the women's side, what's your viewpoint on the women's side? How do you see all of this affecting that side of things?
I don't think it probably affects the women's side as much. I think that The professional game obviously is getting bigger here. It seems like it's got a good foothold now. You are hearing about players jumping into the pros and not going to college, or maybe they go to college for 1 year and then they go. And obviously, there's girls now that are going to Europe after their first or second year of college. You hear about some of our great traditional college programs like North Carolina that lost a ton of players to go on pros and stuff. So, that's happened on the men's side earlier. Now it's happening a little bit on the women's side. But I still think there's a lot of girls that go to college and they're going. I mean, what I've dealt with between men and women coaching both, you look at the women's sideline and you get a girl's brochure and every GPA is 4.0 or above or something. Like they're more disciplined, I would say, the girl side academically, and they want to get into a good school, and I think there's their focus is to get that degree. Sometimes on the boys' side, soccer's getting them into college, and then they're going to go from there. Girls, I think they're a little more academically driven, so I think it's not going to affect the girls' Division One, as much, because I think the girls' side's a little more focused on that side. So we'll see. I mean, again, the girls' side is changing too, and obviously, with our national team, at times not as dominant as they once were. They're starting to questioning college system maybe and stuff too. So we'll see how that goes. But I don't think it's far along as the men's side.
I think I would agree with you there. I don't see it affecting the women's side like it. I could see it possibly affecting the men's side later on down the line. What's your very general question? And this could lead us a lot of different directions, but just give us a sense of your general. And maybe you want to break down again the men's and the women's side. The reason I'm at for our listeners, the reason I'm asking him to break down because there is such a vast difference in how the men are recruited, who the men's coaches are looking for to recruit. Again, the international players, we've got 35 to 38% of the players coming into the NCAA this last year that were from another country, weren't from the United States. Where on the girls' side, it's only 15%. Or so, and there is a true surplus of quality players on the men's side, like genuinely more good players than there are college opportunities. Or on the women's side, I would say there's a shortage of high caliber players to meet the demands that all the college coaches have. And again, Joe, you and I see literally on a daily basis the requests coming in from college coaches around the country on the men's and the women's side, and we can see that influx coming in from the women's side that we don't quite see on the men's side as far as requests for our help to help them find more high quality players. Had another one this morning. Coach just got a job and needs to start over, needs to figure it out and where to find the players. And
Okay.
it's different, right? So
Yeah.
generally on the men's side, we'll start there again first. Give me your, like, when you go see a player, how do you know if a player is a collegiate level player or not? What do you look for?
It's funny. I've questioned this myself over the last couple of years because when I was in Dominguez Hills, Division II school, in the backyard of UCLA, Northridge, Fullerton, LMU, San Diego State, USD, some top D1 schools. We were having some success at Dominguez, some national championships, stuff like that. And now that I'm doing this for a living, I was like, okay, how come we were successful? Like, what were we doing right? And I do feel like my strength was identifying talent. And the funny thing is, I feel like I see some simple things in a player that just sparks my interest. And it's decision making probably more than anything else, just getting out of trouble with a simple pass, making a tackle when he had to, trying a dangerous ball, even though it didn't work out, but he was trying to make something happen. It's like the idea was there. I feel like if I saw a little spark in something in some player, I'd be like, okay, let's watch this kid, you know? And so, and I think it started too because at Dominguez, I wasn't gonna get the top one or two guy from this local club team. I was gonna get the third or fourth guy or fifth guy or something.
Right.
But it got to the point where I was like, I like the fourth or fifth guy maybe better than the first guy because the first guy was just a big athlete, and the other guy was doing all the hard work and doing all the extra stuff. So, as a coach, I mean, as a somebody that's looking at talent, I also feel sometimes, you know, like my son Jack was fast, he scored goals. It's like, okay, anybody can see that, right? And so his club team, when he was going in his sophomore year, they were U17 level, and his Pats ECNL team made it to the semifinals of Nationals, and two guys from that team basically got recruited. My son Jack, who was a grade younger than the rest of the guys are going to be seniors. He was going to be a junior, and but he scored the goals, so he was the leading goal scorer. So everybody kind of sees that, right? The other guy got highly recruited right from there was the guy was a center back. He was 6'4", center back. So, you know, eye test, right? They passed the eye test. Well, meanwhile, these other guys were doing some good work, but didn't get a lot of love. And I was looking around going, why are these other guys not getting some looks? You know, they're doing the work, they're making that pass, they're winning the ball, whatever they're defending. So I always feel like I noticed, I think it's you have to notice certain qualities in players. And it's not just speed and height, it's not just athleticism. There's other things to a soccer player. And I always felt like that was I look back on it now and I really feel like I did a good job of seeing that. There's other things to the game than just speed. And I probably say that because I wasn't the fastest player. So I do feel like soccer IQ is something that you know, sometimes you look back on those Surf Cup years or those tournament years where you're sitting at four fields and you're trying to catch four different games at the same time. And I look back at that time, I'm like, man, that was kind of stupid. Because all you're doing is every time you hear a cheer, you look over and you've missed the cross or you've missed the shot, you've missed the goal, you've heard the cheer, you know, but you're constantly trying to, you're watching too many things. And one of the coaches I know pretty well from Stanford, when he was recruiting my son, he literally came to the playoff game and watched our game. He wasn't trying to watch two or three games at the same time. He's like, this is the game I'm watching. And I was like, that's probably the better way to do it, right? Figure it out. Watch this game. Do you like them or you don't like them? Move on. Don't try to catch, you know, too many things at one point in time because you probably get to catch. You saw 50 players but saw nobody, you know?
I couldn't agree more. And it's so funny you say that because now you got my mind thinking back to my younger days coaching in college. I did exactly what you were saying. I would have two fields minimum, where I'd sit in the corner of four fields and I'm just constantly spinning. Don't want to miss that great player. And as a result, you end up seeing nobody. Yeah, I think that's a great observation because I try to explain this to people all the time. When I see people on the internet post, thank you to the 150 coaches, and they showed all the logos of all the teams, of all the coaches that are going there. But that team, by the way, that those coaches were seeing has got two national team players on it. We know who they're watching. They're not waiting for number 18 to come off the bench. Stanford not waiting for number 18 to come off the bench, hoping she'll be the miraculous player. They're here to study one, two, three kids and study them hard. And make sure that those kids were making good decisions. They're not here just hoping, you know. Like I said, unless you can do three bicycle kicks and two diving headers for goals out of nowhere, and you're the 18th player on the roster, and you come in and that's what you do, then you don't get noticed. I mean, they don't know your name, they don't know who you are, and they really don't care. And so, you know, that we get all excited about, ooh, coaches came to see me. No, they didn't come to see you. They came to see your teammate who's on the national team. That's who they've come to see. And you're
Yeah,
right.
the Stanfords of the world for sure. The only good thing about is again with my son, when he had committed to Notre Dame, we had told the coach, We're like, look, we understand if you know, during showcases and stuff, like if you don't want them there, that's fine, because we know you got to play other players, you know. And he's like, no, we want him there because we feel like he makes us better. He makes the players around him better. And
Right.
coaches want to see that. They want to see the better players. And you know, I know for myself, I would show better around better players, because I wasn't going to go running by four or five guys with the ball. Like I was more of
Right.
a combination guy, right? I needed
Right.
good players around me. So if I was out there by myself, it wouldn't have been good for me.
Right.
So I really feel like, it is good. I mean, you have to be realistic, like you're saying. Are they
Right.
watching the national team player? But also, too, there is opportunities when you're around that player that hopefully, if you can't, and I'm not saying you're the 18th player, but if you're three, four, five, maybe you get a look from another coach
Right.
that's competing with Stanford.
Right.
And I think that's a good arena to be in. We all know, I mean, it is tough. Obviously, those top five schools, even top 10 schools, probably on the women's side, there's a gap after that top 10 school. It's on the men's side, there's probably 25 schools that are probably going to in the mix. On the women's side, there's usually that top 10 that's, has the national team players, and they're
Right.
deep, and they're just reloading every year, so it is, I mean, as a player, you still got to take those opportunities, though, I think. I talk about a lot now with my clients, because they're playing ECNL, they're playing MLS Next, they're going to showcases, and how many times do you need to be seen for a coach to like you or not like you? To me, if you think about it again, we don't want to talk about how old we are, but back in the day, there was Surf Cup and Nomads, maybe, had a big tournament back in the 90s. And that was your big recruiting weekend.
And then State Cup was
And
massive
then
back in the day.
after that, it became local National Cup, State Cup, or some local tournaments. But Surf Cup and the was the only real kind of national kind of showcase that brought
That's
in
right.
teams from outside the area.
Outside the area, you'd have Dallas Cup, maybe, and of course you'd have ODP, which was legitimately the best kids in Southern California.
But
Literally
now
playing
there's
against the
so
best
many.
kids in Northern California.
But now there's so many places to see these kids play. And I just keep on scratching my head sometimes, like, you've seen this kid play five, eight times now. Like, what else do you need to see? He or she is who they are. Like, what else is there? But to me, like, that the recruiting process is to me longer
So
now.
why
Like,
do you
there's a
think that is? Why do you think coach? Because I'm noticing the same thing, where I'll have a coach go see a kid at this event and then that event, and then bring the kid to the camp, and then say the result of that, working with that kid and seeing with that kid play for probably 20 hours, and then to go, yeah, I send me your schedule. I need to see more of you.
Yeah.
It's like, well, how much
No.
more do you need? Why do you think that's happening?
I think it's the only thing I can come up with is because it there is time there is opportunities to go still watch him play. I mean, to me, before, you remember the time where most Division Ones were done by the end of the junior year, right? The end of the junior year of that class. They were pretty much looking the beginning of, say, so this year, Division Ones would be done now for 2025, right? In the past, that's the way it was, and that's not the case there at all anymore. Like, the Division One schools have a lot of roster openings,
And again, we're talking
going.
the men's side
This
mostly.
is the men's side.
But the men's side, right.
So there's, I think there's, since there's more opportunities to play, there's, to me, I guess there's like, do we need to make a decision right now on this player? And it's like, no, we don't. Okay, let's continue to watch. I don't know. To me, like, at some point as a coach, you to me, it's like, I want to get this over with. It's like, we've seen this class enough. Like,
Right.
I want to bring my seven, get that sorted. I'm not ever going to close the door, but I'm like, okay, I've got my seven. We're going to leave one spot open, maybe, but you know. So all I can think of is that there is opportunities to see them play again. Like, where in the past, there was only two or three opportunities to see them, so you knew you had to make a decision. Now, you know you're gonna have a summer showcase, you're gonna have a fall showcase, you're gonna have a winter showcase, you're gonna have a spring showcase.
Right.
You're gonna have multiple opportunities to coach as a coach to go see them play. That's all I can think of.
I think
But
that
it's
combined with the fact that the international game has become so popular and that pro youth academy players don't get released until what would be their senior year. And so, yeah, coaches want a shot
yeah,
at
and it,
that. So they hold those
I think.
roster spots open.
No, I think you're right about the pro thing too,
And transfer
because
portal. And transfer portal.
yeah, for sure. The transfer portal's definitely thrown some chaos into this, but I think you're right about the pro thing too, because I used to always wonder about baseball, how baseball dealt with the draft at such a late time. You know, it's
Right.
like late, it's in June when you have your top guys coming in, all of a sudden they go, oh yeah, we're going pro. And you're like, it's June. You know, like where am
Right.
I finding guys, you know?
Right.
So I think soccer is dealing with that now too, in terms of guys going pro, and I think so. There are kind of, you know, there's these schools that are holding spots open just in case these kids don't go pro. So there's all kinds of variables now. That's the thing. It's not as clean as it was before. Is it better for the player? For some of them, but now there's a lot of players being held in a holding pattern for a lot longer than they were before.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
agree. Now, what, how do you see that in contrast to the women's side?
Yeah, the women's side, I still think that those top players are getting grabbed pretty early. I think that hasn't changed a whole lot. I think there's a cycle with women to where, like, the June 15th date just passed us, and so that 2026 class is now in full recruiting mode, and those national team type players are probably getting those phone calls from those top schools, and maybe some visits now coming in, or I'm sure there's actually some that have already committed.
I saw one yesterday, and I'm sure I missed a bunch of them on social media that
Yeah.
2026 were committed on the 16th. So it's like, well, if coaches can't talk to the players before the 16th, how does that work? It's because they work with coaches as agents and clubs as agents, and conversations have already been had, and unofficial visits have been made already, and it's happening much sooner on the women's side for the top players. I just got off the phone call. You and I were supposed to do this start on the 11 o'clock hour, and I was late because I was on the phone with a not a client, but somebody who just needed some help. And it's a young lady who is the top player on her ECRL team, her RL team. And I just told mom, it's not your turn. It's not her turn. The level of player that she is, it's just got to relax because it's not her turn. And
Yeah.
she is a junior. She's going into her junior year. So she could have gotten a 15th phone call. She is rec of a recruitable age now and didn't get a call. And I just had to explain to mom, it's kind of like being in the schoolyard and picking up teams. Number one, the captains in the schoolyard were always the best players in the school. Right, when we
Right.
played at lunchtime, right? And they never went and picked the worst player first. They always picked the second best player first. And then the guy on the other side would pick the third best player, and he would pick the fourth best player and the fifth player. And everybody else just had to wait their turn. They would get picked up, and that's what I can say on the women's side. Without any doubt, if you, a girl is decent and really wants to play in college, you will get picked up. I'm not that assured on the men's side. I am much more careful on the men's side about what I tell the men, but on the women's side, for sure you'll get picked up. But it's not your turn. You're going to have to wait for all of the other players to get picked up off the schoolyard first, and then you get
Yeah.
the opportunity to prove yourself once you make the team.
No, you're right. And I think, like you're saying, you know, like I said before, it's like there's a cycle, right? This first couple of months is like the top 10% or whatever, and then it's going to slow down once the fall season starts again, and then once that fall showcase or winter showcase comes into play. That second wave is going to get signed, and a lot, they're going to start offering spots or whatever, offering, recruiting the next set of their top people, and then there's going to be another cycle after that as well. I mean, one of my, I currently coach in a high school, and this girl that's a fantastic player, got recruited by a school, a local, a West Coast school, and she committed back in January or February of her junior year, and which was, again, she was kind of freaking out, which this is something that we have to get better at on social media, because social media has created such a frenzy that everybody starts freaking out if they're not getting a spot. It's like everybody needs to kind of pump their brakes a little bit, and like, because we have to understand this cycle, the stuff you're talking about. This is the playground. This is how it's getting chosen. You're going to get a spot. You just got to wait your turn a little bit. And I know, if as a parent, I understand the concern. But anyways, this girl had committed to a West Coast school. Within the last month, that school, her they the coach resigned, so now she's decommitted, and immediately, like, two or three top schools contact her that I don't think were recruiting her before. So there is spots available. There's so much, whether it's because of other movement or whether just people saw players late, whatever it may be, there is going to be opportunity. You just got to kind of be patient and know your turn's coming.
I love that. I love that. I really do, and I think that that's great advice, Joe. One other topic that I want to discuss has kind of been a hot topic lately because it's summertime, and that is ID camps. Number, how to use them, right? How to use an ID camp, when you should go. And this player that I and their mother that I was just talking to sent me some clips, and some of the clips were from some very recognizable Division I names. The schools, and the girl has no business going to any of those based on her film. Based, I told her mom, I said, "You're asking me to assess you based on 6 minutes of film, so I'm going to assess you based on 6 minutes of film and based on where you're playing and based on the level that you're playing against and what I see from the level." And I basically told her, I told her flat out, "You're chasing the wrong schools. You think you're going to play at those schools, I think you're going to be in for a big disappointment." And I pointed her the direction of some schools that I thought she could actually play at. Keeping in mind, this has nothing to do, Joe, with where you want to go to school. I mean, if you want to go to Stanford and you can get into Stanford and your parents can pay for Stanford, then go to Stanford. We're not talking about that. We're talking about playing soccer. That's the reason people are contacting and say, "I want to play my sport. That's what I'm asking for." So based on that, tell me what your perspective is on ID camps. It's a kind of a new phenomenon for you and me. It's not new to it's been going on for 20 years, but you and I didn't do there weren't no such things as college ID camps back in the day. But
No, I mean, honestly, when I started doing ID camps, we charged like 40 to 50 bucks. And the only reason we really did it is because for Division II, you could bring a kid in for a tryout, right? For a 2-hour tryout. But it became a big process to get, you had to have a physical, you had a sickle cell, you had all these different paperwork in like a week in advance to bring a kid out. And we're like, so it got to the point where, like, look, we're missing out on players. Let's do a camp, and we're going to charge minimal money. We'll do two sessions. We'll charge them $50. Well, obviously, that's changed dramatically since then. And I do think, like it or not, the ID camp is part of the process, and it's how we navigate through that, and for each individual is important. And there's got to be some strategy to it. To me, you can't just go to every invite you get, because you're going to spend a ton of money. and you're not going to get a lot of response.
Right.
So I do feel like, when you get going into your sophomore year or whatever, you want to start looking around. To me, the general thing would be like, go to a big school, go to a small private school for D1 or D2, go to a D3, and just look at the campus, look at the location, check out the facilities, you meet the staff, and you kind of get a feel for what you like as an individual. Do you like a small school? Do you like a big school? Oh, I liked going to Cal Berkeley camp. I like that. Okay, then that's kind of where you want. Oh, I liked when I went to this small D3 school. I went to, Claremont McKenna. It was a great little school and great academics. It's like, okay, now we're kind of figuring out where you want to go, what's going to suit you. So the sometimes the bigger camps where you have 10, 20 schools there sounds great to me, but I don't know if you get a lot out of those just because of you're not seeing the campus. You're not really meeting the staff.
Right.
I'm not sure if you're getting much back from that. So I feel like to be, the other thing too, and this is something I just thought about the other day because I was talking to a college coach the other day, and it really made me think that he likes, there's a couple girls that I'm helping out that I put on his radar, and he called me about them. And he said, hey, we would like them to come to our camp in July. And I was like, okay, I'll let them know, whatever. And it made me think like, this coach is, I know him pretty well and good guy, and he knows these players well. And but he still wants to come to the camp. And I was like, okay, I wonder why that is. And I almost feel like now, and you know this as well as I do, like before when there was only five official visits, colleges would want you to make it official because then they knew if I was recruiting Don Williams and I said, Don, I want to bring you on an official visit, and you said, I don't want to take an official. I'll come on an unofficial visit, but I don't want to come to an official visit. Then that coach knows that you're probably not considering me in your top five,
Right,
right?
fair,
I almost feel like now with the ID camp, it's maybe it's something along those lines where a coach is like, hey, come to our camp. And if the player says, yeah, I'll see if I can make it, maybe the coach says, okay, he or she's not really interested. So I'm thinking that might be part of this
no.
puzzle.
I think for a lot of coaches that is legit. Look, the biggest of the big schools, my son coached at North Carolina State. His entire salary was camps. That was it. So he
Yeah,
needed
obviously that's
numbers
a
there. He needed numbers. That's not, people point to those guys and they point to those schools and those situations. But I'm going to say, I guess it's anecdotal because I haven't surveyed everybody in the country. That's not the majority of the coaches. That's not what most coaches are doing. Most coaches are legitimately trying to fill their teams with quality players. And I think that your thought process there as to why, I think that's a legitimate thought process that I do hear actually espoused from coaches if they really are interested. So I've got a girl that's going to Colorado Springs, University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. She had never been to the campus, but she liked the idea of that location. She's from California. So I said, look, you got to go visit the town. Have you ever been there? No, I've driven by it, but I've never been there. You got to go visit. And you've got to go visit the school and you've got to spend time with the coaches and you need to talk to the players. Here's a spring camp. Go to the spring camp. And the coach then knew that she was very interested. Yeah, so that's where she's going. The coach said, yeah, best goalkeeper we had at the camp, and we'll absolutely take her. But that's because she expressed genuine interest in the school. We want to know players are as interested in our school, right, Joe? As the other way around, right? As players want to know that we are sincerely interested in them. I think your point is quite legitimate.
And quite honestly, when my son Jack, after he committed to Notre Dame, I think he went to their camp. So,
There you go.
there's, and
Yeah.
I think they wanted their 2021 recruits or whatever it was, they wanted that class to come to the camp to kind of meet each other or whatever. So there's all these there's different reasons for this to happen, I guess. But the ID camp thing is It is tough to navigate. I do feel like I wish there was some type of better way for coaches to do it. Like, I wish there was more feedback from the camps. I wish the player, the parent would get something in return. I do feel like, you and I talked about this, is to do a camp where it's like, okay, we're going to bring in 50 kids, and then we're going to talk to them and say, okay, here, you 10 are Division One, you 10 are Division Two, you 10 are Division Three, you 10 are in
Right.
between. The rest of you guys are kind of in between, where we don't know where you fit in, but really just give these kids a real, some honest feedback saying, look, you got a great GPA. You should look at some D3 schools, maybe some small private schools at the D1 level or whatever, but give them a map. But like, I say it all the time. Like, when I get on a phone call with a potential client, when they start talking about UCLA or Stanford, I'm like, look, I probably can't help you there. I know those coaches. I know those coaches pretty well. I play with the Stanford coach. The UCLA coach is a friend of mine. I coached against him for years. Getting to those schools is very, very, very difficult. So you're chasing shadows, So giving, what we try to do, I think what I try to do, what you try to do, is give these players that are sophomores and juniors, like, look, you can, Stanford can be a dream school. And like if you can afford it, you can get a school there, fantastic. Like, do you want to not go to Stanford? It's tough. It'd be a tough school to turn down if you get into school.
Right.
But if you want to play soccer, that's probably not your school. If soccer is going to drive this decision, you probably need to look elsewhere, because that's probably going to happen. You got to look at the roster, look at where these kids are from. So I wish the ID camp would give, well, a better roadmap to these players, so they knew kind of where to go and where to really spend their time looking at what school would fit them.
Yeah, and I know some, I don't want to eliminate the some coaches that do it right. There's some coaches who do exactly that. They look at a kid and they say, I got a buddy of mine at a D2 school that would love you. Let me make a phone call. You're such a great kid. And that do help kids and advise kids. And but I think those guys are very, and gals are very few and far between in the process, from what we hear, at least from our clients, at least the feedback that we get from the kids that we know, right?
Yeah, well,
Yeah.
I think what you said too, your example of the Colorado Springs, I think that's a great way to do it. Like, I say to my clients all the time, hey, look at this summer. If you're interested in a school, if you're interested in Cal State Fullerton, okay, let's look at their summer calendar. Okay, they have a camp on July 21st. Okay, go to that camp, and then look at the school. Like, use it as your unofficial visit, but attach a camp to it. That's the way to kind of, don't just go there to the camp and leave. Like, go to the campus, check it out, look at the location, look at the surroundings. Like, if that's a legitimate place that you want to go to, then make it a visit, not just a camp. Make it a visit.
Right. And local ones, it's easy. And that's the first thing that, a lot of parents talk about this. And if you go to a local camp, well, my girl that's going to Christopher Newport, right? So one of the top Division III schools in the country, soccer wise, she lives in Virginia. So to go there was a no-brainer, to go to that Christopher Newport camp. The coach was already recruiting her, and you wonder. Now, when you go out of state, it's a little different. Like the Colorado Springs girl, we got a hold of the coaching staff first, right? They saw her video first and said, oh, there's something here. We would love to have her at our camp. And that begins the conversation. But local kids, it's a great way to get to see the campus and inexpensively. And most local camps at state schools are fairly inexpensive, right? 100 bucks,
Yeah.
150 bucks, still pretty reasonable.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, I do feel, be strategic. And again, if you're going out of state, like, I had a player that was looking at a school back east, and the assistant coach told me that they were pretty much done. And then within the hour, she got an email from the head coach saying, hey, come to our camp, we're still looking at players or something. And I was like, you don't need to go. Like, you're going to spend $1,500 and they're done recruiting. Like, they're not. So, you have to be, especially if you're going out of state, you want to make sure that you probably want to do that kind of early. You don't want to wait till going into your senior year or something. You want to do
Good
that.
point.
And again, be strategic with it and make a weekend out of it, because you don't just want to fly in and fly out type thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point. I do. Well, Joe, we've been at this for about an hour, a little over an hour, I think. And I just wanted to hear what your viewpoint of it, because you have a very unusual experience having won two national championships and having spent your entire career in Southern California, the youth soccer mecca of the world. That's like no other. And your weekend, in fact, I think you've been busy this last weekend, haven't you? Were you out and about this working this last week?
Actually, I haven't been, but I'm going to Seattle tonight
Oh,
for
there
the
you
Eastern Hill
go.
Girls, and then I'll be
Okay.
coming back and going down to San Diego for the Eastern Hill Boys. So the next, week to 10 days is going to be on the soccer field. But yeah, I think the other part you're mentioning, like, the we both have college experience and stuff, and obviously I've won a little bit, but I think the other part is having, I've had three kids that have gone through recruiting, and my fourth is now eligible. She got a couple, she's been on a phone call or two now,
All right.
after the
Exciting.
June 15th. So I try to wear both hats, right, of a coach and a parent, and so I do feel like that's a somewhat unique, because I'm still in the middle of it. So you've gone through it with your son and stuff,
Yeah.
but I'm still going through it, and I still have that kind of perspective of, and talking to my daughter's friends and their parents, and what trying to help them at times, and there's a couple there that are my clients, and trying to walk them through some stuff. And so I'm still kind of in that environment, and
Very
I feel
much.
like that's a big thing. And again, staying current, like we talked about, the changes that are going on, to stay
Yes.
current for you and I is our job. And it that's the and for a regular parent that's got a regular job, to stay up current with this stuff is crazy, so and the and these teams are busy, right? These players are busier now than ever before. I do feel like us staying current and staying involved and trying to guide these players and parents through this process is a great resource, for this current environment.
That's excellent. That's a really good way to wrap it up. Joe, tell everybody how, and we'll give the links down in the comment sections of the video when this goes up. But how do people get a hold of you if they want questions, or they have questions about college soccer, or maybe they want to ask about you about helping them or their player? How do they get a hold of you?
I mean, mainly, obviously, is email and cell. My email is joe.flanagan, FLANAGAN, at srusasoccer.com.
And they can find you on social media a little bit too, right?
Yeah, social media. It's like, I feel social. I look at my social media stuff. I don't post a whole lot, but I try to keep up with as much as I can. I follow, obviously, Don does a lot of stuff, and follow, watch it, look at, read his comments, stuff like that. So, on Facebook and Twitter, stuff like that too. But most of the, I mean, I'm on my cell phone all the time. If if you text me, I usually respond
Yeah.
pretty quickly.
Right.
So that's usually my, I'm a little old school, I guess, with that. Like, it's funny to think that I'm old school and I'm using a cell phone. That's my old school way, because everybody else is more social media savvy than I am. But
That's
yeah, I
fair.
mean, cells 310-864-6583. So, I'm always out and about and still involved, and watching a ton of games. So, be happy to help anybody out.
Right on. Thanks, Joe, for joining us on Inside College Soccer. I really appreciate your time.